Hey, what's up, everybody? Today, I had the pleasure to chat with award-winning Canadian singer-songwriter, record producer, teacher, writer, and public speaker, Lynn Miles. In this newest episode, Lynn sits down with me to have an in-depth chat about her new album, Tumbleweedy World, Gravitation Towards the Dobro, enjoyment of performing live, affection for co-writing, being empowered by wilderness, becoming a voice teacher, experience teaching 14-year-old Alanis Morissette, tribute song to Merle Haggard, admiration for Emmylou Harris, Ronnie Crowell, importance of creating more awareness for mental health, where her passion for giving back originated from, embracing joy, and more. Now, with that being said, hope you enjoy my conversation with Lynn. Lynn, hello.
Hi, Jigme. Thanks for having me on the show. Finally, we've tried to connect three times. This is our third time, so that's awesome.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a pleasure to have you on, and we've got a lot to talk about since the last time that we connected. I mean, you've got a new album out called Tumbleweedy World. Tell me about the reception that people have gotten from your new record.
It's been so great. It's getting airplay all over the world, and it's gotten, glowing reviews. We did three sold out CD release shows, concerts, and yeah, it's been a really positive experience all around.
Yeah, absolutely. And we have to talk about, I guess, the songs on the album that have really stood out of anything that I guess you've created. But I mean, there's got to be at least some favorite stuff that you've recorded on that album that personally I think you feel that could have stood out to you. What are songs on the album that sort of resonated most with you?
Well, so you're asking me to rate my children, so I can't do that. Like I put the songs on the album that I think belong together, and I love them all, and no matter and all their idiosyncrasies and their flaws. So I can't say that there's one that I like more than the other. The thing that I like about the album is the instrumentation, which I've always wanted to make a record with. Sort of bluegrassy sounding instruments, especially dobro. So that sort of made me the happiest. So I would say instead of the song to pick, I would pick the dobro as my favorite part of the record.
Absolutely. What is it about the dobro? 'Cause I've heard the dobro before, in many songs I've listened to, including Emmylou Harris's songs, Linda Ronstadt songs, Dolly Parton songs, and country songs or bluegrass songs in general. What was it about that instrument that sort of just stuck with you?
The dobro sounds like it's 1,000 years old. You can hear the wood and the strings, and it has a darkness to it that I love. It has a kind of a longing to it, and a darkness, and an earthiness to it. And it's an instrument I've always loved. So I hope that explains. I hope that's, painted a good picture there for your listeners of.
Yeah, absolutely. And do you feel that sort of connected with that song Night Owl that you also put on this album as well?
Exactly. And if you listen to it, it's the first song, and the first sound you hear on the record is a dobro slide. And then I come in really gently with my guitar, and it's a song about being a person who's a night owl, which is me. And so there's a darkness to the tone of the dobro, and I thought that lended itself to the lyrics of the song.
Yeah, and there's a lot of great songs on that album, including Highway 105, I guess, was sort of the, I don't know how to really describe a Highway 105. I mean, I guess it's a journey of, I guess, the darkness, that also that you were talking about earlier, and then but also taking a journey down these many musical instruments that you've sort of honed in on your whole entire life and sort of played while growing up. And I guess that sort of coincided with the whole album and the concept behind it. What was the process like, sort of going through these musical instruments, but also incorporating them in different ways to make the album sound sort of unique in its own way?
Well, it was a joyous experience, and so when we recorded live off the floor mostly, so I had we had the dobro player in one room. We had a guitar player to my left, and then I had a bass player to my right, and we all saw each other and watched each other play. And then And then we listen to it and we think, okay, do we need to add anything? So we added some banjo on some things, and some fiddle on some other things, and a couple overdubs of maybe mandolin if we didn't feel like he'd gotten the right take or we wanted to add more, we would work like that. But it was really joyous in the fact that I was just sitting there playing live, like much like you would do in a concert. And just kept, trying the songs in different ways and experimenting, and it was a great experience.
For sure. And I guess one of the more interesting songs on the record is Johnny Without June. And you kind of told the story over and over again about this, I guess your student, one of your students who sort of wrote this one part or a lyric that sort of stood out to you. And she kind of, you kind of asked her to show her what the lyrics was and what she wanted to write about. And there was one line in it. I forget what the line was, but there was just something about that line that you resonated with, which then you recorded on the album on this Tumbleweedy World. Talk to me about the, I guess the process behind how that sort of came to be.
Yeah, well, I was teaching in a songwriting class in Halifax, and I had about 20 students, maybe less than 20. I always think it's 20, but anyway. And I always ask people, okay, what do you want to talk about in this class? And she said, well, I write lyrics, but I don't play an instrument and I don't sing, so I have no one to write the music. And I said, well, can I look at the lyrics? So I looked at the lyric, and it was absolutely beautiful. And I was really gobsmacked, and I just said, well, if you'd like, I could try to write the music for this. And she said, oh yeah, please do. So, and the line that I was really attracted to is in the chorus. I'm a sailor lost at sea, learning how deep blue can be, which really resonated with me because I love all those deep blue colors. And so I took it home and I worked on it, and I kept sending her little versions of it. And then I thought it needed a bridge, so I wrote a bridge and she liked it. So and I just think it's such a beautiful, lyrically crafted song that I don't do a lot of co-writes on my records. I have very few. I think I have two. So hers is one of the only two that I think I've ever had, because I write so many songs myself. But I just thought it suited the instrumentation of the record. I love the sentiment of the song, and I just thought it belonged with the songs. And her name is Maxine Wallace, and she lives in on the East Coast of Canada.
Yeah, and I guess the really cool part about this whole thing for you is that not only do you like to create music on your own and create music with the band that you do that you play with and perform with, but you also find the excitement in also nurturing other young aspiring songwriters and singers to write their own music, but also helping them, I guess, form their songwriting craft. Do you find the joy in just doing that as well as, you know, playing music on your own and creating with the band?
I love it. I've been a mentor at the Banff Centre for the Performing Arts in the songwriting program. I've done that a couple times, and it's so rewarding, and I learn a lot, because whenever you're in another room with another songwriter, you'll see somebody work in a way that you don't work, and that's always good to see that and to learn from that. So whether they're a new songwriter or they've been doing it for a while, you can always learn. So that's really fun. And I love encouraging people to write. And I love it when I'm teaching them and something clicks with them, and they'll go away and come back and they'll say, oh, I wrote a verse or something, and they get really excited about it because I understand what it feels like to complete a song. It's the greatest feeling. So I love encouraging other people. And I also, especially with younger performers, I want to help them avoid some of the pitfalls that you can find yourself falling into early days on when you're starting and you don't have a lot of information or you're insecure or any of that stuff. So I like helping people for sure.
Yeah, and I want to read a quote that I listened to one of the interviews that you were doing, and I guess one of the hosts kind of asked you about, you know, I guess your experiences performing on stage and performing live, and you said, "No, I loved it. Yeah, I'm an extrovert or introvert, so I'm happy when I'm alone and I'm happy when I'm on stage." Yeah, I loved being on stage. I still love being on stage. I love playing my songs. Actually, I do enjoy a nice one-on-one conversation when there isn't a lot of small talk. I find small talk quite exhausting. But yeah, I love to be on stage. I love playing my tunes on stage for people who want to hear them. It's like my favorite thing. And so with the long, and I guess the amount of years that you've been doing this for your career, do you still find that joy of performing on a stage, even if it's not big? It could be a small stage, but do you still find the joy in performing?
Oh yeah, I enjoy it more now than I ever did. I think that has to do with the comfort that I've and self-awareness that I have as I get older. As I get older, the more I know myself, the more I know the things that might trouble me or make me happy, and I learn how to deal with stress and anxiety and all that kind of stuff. And but so it makes being on stage, there's something about being on stage and knowing who you are. That combination is just incredibly powerful. And for me, it's I just look forward to it every time. And my goal is to always do a better show than I did the last time. So I have sort of goal oriented to try to outdo myself from the last show and have more fun and sing better, play better, so that I'm always kind of working at it. I never want to phone it in. I want to always be incredibly present and do the best show I can possibly do, and that brings me a lot of joy.
Yeah, and the album title called Tumbleweedy World, I guess I was listening to just a few hours ago about why you sort of came up with that title, and you sort of said it was in, I guess, in COVID times when it was, there was so much silence going on, and you kind of thought that there was going to be like a tumbleweed rolling down the street, and I guess that's one of the
Yeah.
main factors going into the title naming Tumbleweedy World. But also, what I found fascinating about you is that not only do you like to help other people, but you feel influenced by the environment, and you feel influenced by immersing yourself, I guess, in nature and the wilderness, I guess, so to speak. Because you did say, I'll just read books or go online or read articles about the wilderness, and I'll just wander through the woods. And what am I picking up on here? What does it mean? What does the actual concept mean to me? I'll just write pages and pages of the concept and stuff. And also write, I like words. I'm a bit of a word nerd. So if there's a word that I love, I'll write it down. And if I think it relates to the song, then I'll try to get that in somewhere because I like words that are evocative. Do you feel that still connects with this whole album that you've created now?
I hope so. I feel like of all the records that I've done, this is kind of the only record I've done where I cared equally about, well, no, that doesn't sound right. This record was made so that I could serve the instrumentation. And usually I make records that absolutely serve the song. So this one sort of this has more to do, it's sort of an equal thing where I took the songs that I loved and wanted to hear in a very specific way, and then got the instrumentation that I loved and wanted to hear in a certain way, and found the songs that matched that, and found the instruments that matched that, and did it that way. Most of my other records, this is my 16th album, so most of my other records were very, very song based. So I would be working on the songs, and then I would let the song decide what kind of treatment it wanted. So I'll have a record that will have some drums on it, some solo tunes, piano, because I would only focus on, okay, this, what is the song? What is this? How does the song want to feel? And what instrumentation is actually going to serve this song? Whereas these songs are really specifically chosen to match up with instrumentation I'd already chosen, it's sort of like more of a project album than just a like totally free kind of album experience, but which I loved. Like I also love having a project. I have an album of I wrote a whole show about winter and secular Christmas, and every year I write another song for it because I love having a project that I can write something for. So I don't know if that explains. That gives you a good answer too.
No, I totally get that. And do you also find the joy in, I guess, co-writing also, in your career? You said, first of all, you have to trust the other person. The rule I have is that you can say anything you want and you won't get laughed at. You know, even if it's a goofy idea, you have to put it on the table because it might evolve into something really fabulous. But we have to hear it first. And as soon as you're sort of editing yourself of what you're going to say, then you're editing yourself. The initial outline for outline for songwriting is to not edit yourself, to write every stupid thing you can kind of come up with, whatever it is, you put it out on the table and then you look at it and say, okay, what is this? What can we do with this idea here? And so the people I write with are willing to do that, which I appreciate. And so when we're talking about this whole Tumbleweedy World album and your career in general, what sticks out to me from that quote is that you really are self-aware about what you like and what you don't like. And also creating that openness to write music that might be bad, but also just putting it on the side, but not throwing it out because that can go somewhere into a next project if you don't feel like it belongs on this one album. How much of that sort of goes into your creative process with music?
All of it goes in. So I never, if I have an idea, I write it down. I never dismiss it, or I'm never rude to the idea, because ideas are just gold. You know, whether your ego decides it's not good enough, or your self-esteem, you know, gets in the way of whatever, I just like let it sit there for a while, because I know that if something comes up, it's kind of your soul talking. It's your subconscious talking. If something comes up, there's something there and it wants to be expressed. It might not be expressed this year. It might be expressed in 10 years. But as long as it's written down, it exists and you can go back to it. And as you grow as a human being, you can look back and go, oh, I think I know what I was trying to talk about then, because I didn't really know enough about it, but now I do. So I think if you live your life as an artist, everything you do is part of that life, and it's a long life, and you can look at something that you wrote, and I've done this before. I've written a thing down and, you know, put the book away, and then I'll look at the book 10 years later and see it, and I go, oh, I can write that song now. You know, so it happens, and I think if you don't write it down, it's gone forever. I really believe in the actual physical process of writing things down.
Yeah, and you moved from Ottawa to Nashville, then to Los Angeles, then back to Ottawa. Is that where you currently live right now?
I never actually lived in Nashville. I lived in Austin briefly, but I had a publishing deal in Nashville. I lived in LA for 4 years and I had a publishing deal there. And now I live in Ottawa. I lived in Toronto for several years as well, but I live in Ottawa right now, yeah.
Yeah, and there's something about I guess fascinating. I will use that word again, to really see what you're doing in your career, because you also like to, I guess, vocal teaching. And what I didn't know is that you actually taught a 14-year-old Alanis Morissette. What do you remember about teaching that 14-year-old Alanis?
Well, I was, I think, in my 30s, and she was a teenager, and she was much more mature than I was at the time, and fully formed and very talented, very driven, very focused. You know, I felt like a kid when I was around her, because she had her shit together. And I never have. So yeah, she was very impressive. And you know, I've met people like her in the business, and there's just a different breed of people. They have some kind of, I don't know, thing in their head. It just, you can tell as soon as you meet them, you go, oh yeah, okay, so they're on this path here. And it's not a path that I ever wanted to walk on, but yeah, she was fully formed when she was 13. She was ready to go.
Yeah. And when I look up on Alanis Morissette, what really strikes me is now she's a 7-time Grammy winner, 14-time Juno winning and Brit Award recipient. She's also sold over 75 million records worldwide. And has also been recognized as the queen of alt rock angst by Rolling Stone. So when you think about, the moment when you're teaching, I guess, Alanis Morissette when she's 14 years old. And then come to find out, here is, that 14-year-old you're teaching now has gone on global stardom. What comes to mind when you think about that?
I don't think she needed any lessons from me. I think she was, as I say, fully formed. It was really just sort of some vocal exercises. It wasn't, I didn't teach her for a long time. I don't think I informed anything that she does now. I think she was already there, sort of. So I don't think it had anything to do with me. But yeah, so she's very talented and very rich.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's what we're all wishing for. So there's so much things that we've already talked about so far in this interview, but I also want to go back to talking about, I guess not only the songs on the album that we've already touched on earlier, but I want to talk about the meaning behind Tumbleweedy World, because I don't think we've touched on that yet. Because you did say that these are songs that arrive at a moment when global instability illuminated the fragility of personal relationships. They're about impermanence. Talk to me about sort of the premise, I guess, the premise behind Tumbleweedy World.
Well, I do a lot of writing about relationships, not, brokenhearted stuff, some brokenhearted stuff, but really about like I do write about the fragility of relationships. They are fragile and they're completely based on each person's ego and lack of or awareness, self-awareness or lack of self-awareness. And so when something like a pandemic hits, it makes people even more vulnerable than they were when times were good. You really do see what people are made out of. So, and the other thing about it was just the silence around everything was so quiet and so instrumentally, I didn't want to have any drums. I just wanted something that behind what you were hearing, there was nothing, which is what the world felt like to me, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And you also have very, I guess, very much so a ton of influences on this album as well. When it comes to artist wise, I think we've touched on the influences of the environment and nature, and also the fragility of relationships that we've talked about just now. But you also have that inspiration of different artists on that album. One including, which I really loved, was I guess a tribute to Merle Haggard. And you had a line in there talking about, the day that Merle Haggard died.
Yeah, that's on a previous album. So I on my on the album called We'll Look for Stars, which also came out in the pandemic, I put the song Merle because I met Merle and it was about the day that Merle Haggard died. Grown men sat and cried, gospel singers testified on the day Merle Haggard died. But that's on the previous record. Yeah, but yeah. Love Merle Haggard. Yeah, so I'm very influenced by I grew up listening to my father listened to jazz, my mother listened to country music and opera, and my brother listened to all kinds of rock music and singer-songwriters and Zeppelin and all that stuff. So I've heard and we lived in London, Ontario, so we could get the Motown station on our TV for on our radio, sorry, and we would watch Soul Train on Saturday mornings on TV. And so I heard a lot of Motown stuff. So, and then my first album that I ever bought was Carole King Tapestry record, which was a, one of the greatest singer-songwriter records ever made. And so I have all those influences, but I love acoustic music. I love bluegrass music. So I have a lot of influences for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. And Carole King, I guess if I'm not mistaken, I think Tapestry was the album that You Make Me Feel Like a Natural Woman was on. If I'm not mistaken. So yeah, I mean, Carole King has been one of the, I guess, the staples of songwriters, in music, and she still is.
Well, here's an
And
interesting fact that the Carole King record was the biggest selling record by a woman artist until Alanis Morissette. There's an interesting fact.
well, there you go.
Yeah.
So we also have to talk about, you're very in tune with also the importance of mental health.
Absolutely.
And I guess people don't talk about it often within interviews, because I feel it's a topic that people get afraid of talking about most,
Yeah.
most importantly, and now I want to talk about it because I feel that's important to you and the work that you do there, because you're very aware and dedicate your time to also raising money for charities, and giving back to people. Was it just something in your nature that you've always had in you, or was that just something that sparked from growing up, I guess?
I think my mother instilled the idea of being kind. And my mother, I was not allowed to use the word hate ever in my life. My mother passed away in December, so I can still feel her saying, never, never say the word hate. And also to give back and to be kind. And if somebody's suffering, try to help them. So that's all from my beautiful mother, Irene. And also for me, I'm 64. I've been playing music since my teens, and I've gone through in that time I've gone through suicidal depressions and anxiety, a couple of sorry, can't remember what they're called. Anyway, sessions of times of great strife and mental illness, and a lot of it. If you're self-aware, if you're trying to be self-aware, if you're a writer, if you're creating something, the more you know yourself, the better your writing is going to be. So part of the journey of as a writer for me is to explore why I feel the things that I feel. So I have delved into the mental health side of things. I've read every book imaginable. I've had therapy. I've taken medication. And I know that, and you can see it recently, like with people like Shawn Mendes and other sort of contemporary artists who've canceled tours because of their mental health. I think that stuff is starting to win because, the reason the 27 Club exists is because those people were so stressed. It's such a stressful industry. There's so much pressure. And then you add on top of it sort of like the sensitivity of the artist. Whatever mental health issues they're dealing with, body image issues, all that stuff, it's too much for some people. And so I think when you're a young artist, you need to get a handle on that stuff. You need to understand what triggers you to become anxious or depressed and try to either figure out how to avoid it or figure out how to deal with it, so that you're not dealing with it with substance abuse or self-harm or, bad relationships or. So I think that's the key to having a long career, really. And it's also the key to knowing yourself as an artist. If you know what's going on inside your head, that's a win-win for an artist for sure. So yeah, so
Absolutely.
I talk about it, especially with younger people. I always say, they say, "Well, what should I do?" I say, "Well, number one thing, make sure your mental health is good and your physical health, because if you're going to go on the road, it's exhausting." So both of those things are incredibly important, and they serve each other, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, like, you're obviously very clear and adamant about talking about it and creating awareness about it. But if there was one thing that you could tell, I guess, your younger self now that you've grown older now, if there's something that earlier in your life that you sort of would want to tell that younger self, what would that be?
Okay, it's funny because since my mom died, I've been looking at pictures of my childhood, right? And you don't look at pictures very often. You do if you have a phone. But back in the day when you didn't have a phone, you'd take a picture and you'd put it in a box. So I'm looking at these pictures and I'm looking at myself, and I'm this gorgeous young thing. Like I'm pretty and skinny and I've got beautiful skin and beautiful hair. And I remember at the time thinking, God, I'm so ugly. Nobody loves me. My songs are horrible. All that stuff that you do when you're younger, you're constantly, especially for women, you're constantly sort of attacking yourself and telling yourself how not good you are. So I would say, like, take that from me. Know that that's what's happening, and that eventually you will look back on it and think, oh, I was actually pretty good, or I actually. My songs are pretty good and I look pretty good and I'm fine, So I would say the self-criticism, to step away from the self-criticism, don't let it be too personal. Let it, if you're going to be critical of your art, that's fine because it helps you get better. But don't be nasty to yourself. Don't bully yourself. Be kind to yourself in every way, emotionally, mentally, physically. Just be kind to yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, as we're wrapping up here, I want to ask you these couple of final questions I had for you. And, you know, these questions have challenged almost every single person that has come on this podcast.
Okay.
and I've really enjoyed this, I guess, thoughtful conversation that we're having, because I think it's important to have these really personal conversations.
I do too.
If there was one artist that is in heaven right now that you would want to play a song with, who would it be, and what song would you play?
Oh my God. Well, Prince. What song would I play? Oh God. I think I just want to sing harmony on Purple Rain, actually. I heard Purple Rain a couple of weeks ago. I was like, God, this is a fantastic anthem. Like, it's so good. The guitar playing is so good. He's so awesome. Like, all his songs are great. But there's just something about that one, because that was the one that introduced me to him. I wish he was here. See, there's an example of someone who's gone too soon, who was having physical problems and, you know, turned to medication and wasn't being regulated. And, you know, what a great loss that is. It's just another example of that. So anyway, but yeah, I think I would just want to sing harmony with Prince on Purple Rain.
Yeah, for sure. And right behind me is a poster of
oh, there he is. I know. Oh, that's him. And that's him in
Prince.
Purple Rain. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's
So,
him in the movie. Yeah.
So
there you go.
It's a great song, and Prince is forever a legend and an icon in the music business. I mean, okay, so for this last question, I will say, what is the most personal, immersive, out of body experience you've had in music?
Oh. Well, I performed with the National Arts Center Orchestra. I performed my music, and it had been arranged by a friend of mine. And I was just standing on stage singing with an orchestra. And that was, I felt, and, you know, and it was a huge room. It was the National Arts Center, so it's several thousand people. And I felt, looking back at it, I thought, I should be nervous about this, but I'm not nervous about this. I feel so prepared and so ready to do this that it was sort of the most relaxed I've ever been on stage, and I felt really free. Oh, and I don't know why. I just kind of, I don't know how I did it, but I just did it. And I, if I could capture that, whatever that was, that sense of freedom and confidence, I don't know. But it was really a glorious evening. The whole thing was just glorious.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's been a pleasure to chat with you, and it's the end of our time together. But thank you so much. It was such a honor to be able to really pick your brain about your music and pick your brain about the music business in general.
Well, thank you for having me on your show, Jamie. I really appreciate it. It's great to talk to you. You ask great questions, so that's fun.
Yeah, thank you so much. Well, I mean, all the credit goes to you for creating such great music. And before we even go, I'd really need to say that your music kind of reminds me of Rodney Crowell and Emmylou Harris.
I love them both.
just something about some of the songs on this album take me back to Rodney Crowell's music, and Emmylou Harris's days.
Well, they're both big influences for me. Absolutely. Yeah. So thank you for that. That's a compliment to me. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much. And to the listeners who made it this far into the episode, thanks so much for sticking around. I hope you join my conversation with award-winning Canadian singer-songwriter, record producer, teacher, writer, and public speaker, Lynn Miles. If you want to connect with Lynn, you can connect with her on Facebook on Lynn Miles Music or via her website, lynnmiles.ca. You can also help support my show. Please feel free to share with family, friends, or on social media. You can also find me on all podcast platforms. I've been your host, Jamie Kelsing. Thanks for tuning into the show.